This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
And in both those books, there's such a sublime quality of yearning. Yearning for something that's been lost. Yearning for something that didn't happen. I mean, Little Women, you can almost smell it coming off the page. I mean, that is the family that Louisa May Alcott so desperately, desperately wanted to have.
That's Susan Cheever talking about Louisa May Alcott and the other writers of American Bloomsbury. Later on, author Pamela Thompson will join us live to talk about her wonderful debut novel, Every Past Thing. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today's show begins in the early 19th century and ends in that century's last year, 1899. We start our time travel with our first guest, Susan Cheever. She takes us to Concord, Massachusetts, where a genius cluster of great American writers gathered around Ralph Waldo Emerson. Her book is American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, and Henry David Thoreau, Their Lives, Their Loves, Their Work. When I spoke to her in March of 2007, she told Writer's Voice that the group invented a new kind of American literature. Now, you say that these folks were the first professional authors. What do you mean by that?
Well, they were the first group of American writers. I mean, there were professional authors in England, but they were the first professional authors in the United States. I mean, before them, there were not people who made a living writing books. It was sort of a new idea, and it was part of this whole explosion of creativity and joy, really, which happened in New England in the 1840s and 50s, which was quite extraordinary, and very much like what happened in this country in the 1960s. There was this kind of outpouring of freedom, and, you know, Emerson's essay Self-Reliance was really part of this emphasis on the individual, which was brand new. And I think that until then, in other words, the revolution was in 1776, and so it took about 50 years for it to sink in that we could enjoy European things without being afraid of being dominated by Europe, and that we could have a love affair with nature instead of thinking of nature as a terrible enemy that we needed to beat down in order to survive. And we could imagine a God who existed in other people or in nature instead of a punishing Puritan God. So all these things kind of came together at once. You know, you even had Nathaniel Hawthorne saying, I want my own thing. He didn't say I want to do my own thing, but he practically did.
And of course, Thoreau said, turn on, tune in, and drop out, although maybe he didn't say turn on. Now, you know, you mentioned the 60s, and I've thought often that it was a kind of a resurgence of American Romanticism that was like German Romanticism or even the Rousseauian French Romanticism. And when I read your book, it occurred to me that this was an earlier connection there. Can you say that this was like an American Romantic movement allied
exactly.
to those?
Exactly. That's what it is. It's the first American Romantic movement. And it was quite electrifying. I mean, and for the first time, intellectuals went back and forth from England, and Margaret Fuller brought German literature to Concord. So all these, it was extremely exciting. And I think that people felt, or certainly writers felt, and intellectuals felt, and poets felt that, you know, for the first time they were able to plumb the landscape of the human heart. Because before that, it had really been about surviving and surviving as the United States.
And they were called the Transcendentalists. What were they transcending, and why were they transcending it?
You know, there's a huge amount of discussion about what Transcendentalism means, and no real conclusion. But clearly, what they transcended were the old Puritan ways. All the rules and regulations about society, certainly all the rules and regulations about what you can and can't believe when it comes to God. Emerson gave a very famous speech at the Harvard Divinity School, which got him kicked out of Harvard for 30 years. saying that essentially God is everywhere. So transcending those old strictures about, you know, what God was and what God wasn't. And also to some extent, you know, they transcended these rules about marriage and these rules about what women did and what women didn't do. You know, it was about transcending the old ways, the old rules and regulations, and coming to a new understanding of what it meant to be human in this beautiful place. And certainly Margaret Fuller, for instance, transcended very much the idea of what it had meant to be a woman. Of course, everybody believed in those days that women were inferior in every way. And, you know, Margaret Fuller was the editor of the Herald Tribune. She was a foreign correspondent. She didn't get married, you know. And
she had a child out of wedlock.
She had a child out of wedlock. She, you know, fell in love with who she pleased. She did what she pleased. She was educated as if she was a man, which is to say she was educated at all. But, you know, at the same time, they thought it was a big deal to let her use the Harvard Library. So, you know, the idea of a woman even going to Harvard was just not dreamt of in their philosophy. They transcended really the old ways, and they called it the newness or the awakening, and I think it felt that way. I think it was a very exciting time to be alive.
You're listening to Writer's Voice on Valley Free Radio. Visit our website at www.writersvoice.net. You can find links to our podcast there, which is also podcasting on Valley Free Radio, as well as other links and information about the show and the show's guests. Now, Susan Cheever, you paint a picture of a new sensual and even sexual freedom. Certainly, there's a whole kind of undercurrent of eroticism that you talk about in the book, and a lot of multiple and even intersecting love triangles. But you also call them high-minded prudes, where, you know, this was a time when even table legs were hidden. You know, in other words, there are a lot of contradictions here. Give us some examples first of who was in love with whom, and then talk about how they worked with these kind of contradictory elements.
Well, I think the high-minded prudes were not... I think these people were not, in general, high-minded prudes. In other words, I think the prudishness was really what they were trying to put behind them. You know, the people who felt that you couldn't hang clothes on the line without putting a pillowcase over the clothes left men see ladies under things. I think that, you know, the transcendentalists, if we're going to call them that, were very much trying to get away from that. But the love triangles are sort of interesting. Because it was such a close-knit and intimate community, there was a great deal, and I'm using the word love and the word love affair not literally, but there was a great deal of intimate connection. Both of the Thoreau brothers fell in love with the same woman, and first John Thoreau proposed to her and she turned him down, and then Henry David Thoreau proposed to her and she turned him down. And then both Nathaniel Hawthorne and Ralph Waldo Emerson were very involved with Margaret Fuller, to the extent where Emerson got so jealous that he, you know, had the Hawthornes kicked out of Concord, essentially. And then Thoreau lived at the Emerson's house, and he and Mrs. Emerson became very close friends, especially when Emerson would be gone for a year. In fact, that's how Thoreau ended up going to Walden. He had been living at the Emersons for a year while Emerson was abroad, and the Emerson children adored Thoreau. All children adored Thoreau, and Emerson's wife, Lydian, loved Thoreau, and he loved her, and Emerson came home, and of course, the house was way too small for the Emerson/Thoreau family and the Emerson-Emerson family, so Emerson said to Thoreau, you know, you can't stay here. And Thoreau said, well, I don't really have anywhere to go. And Emerson said, well, you know, I have a woodlot I just bought out on Walden Pond for $89. Why don't you go out there and build a cabin and live out there for a while? And that's why Thoreau went out there. He wasn't intending to be a hermit. He just didn't have anywhere else to live.
You just said you don't say love affair literally. So there is a way in which I think there these heated passions, you even suggest that they may have been as heated as they were because you don't think that they were consummated.
I don't think that they were, but I'm not sure. And I think all scholars and unscholars of these people very much wish that there was more documentation on this. But I certainly couldn't find it. I mean, I looked, you know, I imagined finding a letter from Emerson to Margaret Fuller, but I didn't find it. It's at the moment not there, although letters are turning up all the time. In the last 6 months.
Really?
Interesting things have turned up. Yes, Thoreau, as you know, at one point built a fire in an old stump to roast some fish and set fire to Concord, to 300 acres of it. And the people whose land was burned, letters have just surfaced of theirs. So, you know, things are still coming to light in people's attics, the famous New England attic. And then I just learned, you know, the famous story of how Louisa came to write Little Women.
Yes, tell our listeners that. That was quite a surprise.
Yes. Well, that was one of the first things I came on back when I was starting with this. But she had written a novel called Moods, which she thought was a wonderful novel and her breakthrough novel. And it was about a woman very much like her who was in love with a man very much like Emerson and another man very much like Thoreau, and the agony of her choice. And she thought it was going to be the novel that put her on the map as a serious literary person, and it didn't. And it also got a very bad review from Henry James, who said the ignorance of this writer about human nature is equaled only by the confidence of this writer in what she knows about human nature. I mean, a really mean review. Anyway, she then went down to Washington to work in a hospital during the Civil War, which was a really life-changing experience for her. And, of course, she also got very sick down there and was given medication that made her even sicker. And she came home, and then she wrote a little book called Hospital Sketches about her time in Washington, in which I think she really found her mature style. And then she wanted to write another significant novel. So she went to her editor, Thomas Niles of Tickner and Fields, and she said to him, okay, I want to write a really significant novel. And he said, well, I can't sell a book like that you would write. And she said, well, what could you sell? And he said, well, the only thing I could possibly sell that you could write would be a book for young girls. And she said, absolutely not. She said, after everything I've been through, I am not going to go back and write children's literature. So he said, well, too bad. That's the only thing I'll publish. And she, you know, in a complete sort of fit, and she had been very discouraged before, so she was used to having people tell her that she couldn't do what she needed to do as an artist. But anyway, she went to Boston. She turned him down and went to Boston. And what Thomas Niles did was he wrote to Louisa's father, Bronson Alcott. And this is a letter I just saw for the first time about a month ago. He wrote Bronson a letter saying, you know, I really wish that Louisa would write this book for young women, and I think I would be able to, you know, pay her enough to make a difference to your family. And of course, Bronson, if she was to write this book for young women, I'm sure I could see my way to publishing a book of yours.
Wow.
So it was a double bribe. Mm-hmm. And Bronson wrote to Louisa and sort of summoned her home. And she was in a rage. She felt violated as a writer. She felt that she was going against all her creative instincts. She was very sick. She was a spinster. She had given up everything for this hungry family of origin that she came from. And she went back to Concord in a rage and sat down at the stinky little desk that her father had built for her, just in a fury, and as I say, very sick, so sick that she couldn't write with her right hand. She had to learn to write with her left hand. And in about 6 weeks, she wrote, you know, one of the best-selling books of all time.
And we're talking with Susan Cheever about her book, American Bloomsbury. You know, there's a wonderful passage in your book. Do you have your book with you there?
Yes, I do.
Because you describe what it was like for her to write this book.
Sure.
I wonder if you could read those paragraphs, starting when she looked up during the day, and if you could read it down to her teacher and friend Thoreau.
Okay, yep, this is chapter 47, so...
Or maybe actually down to across the hall, the three paragraphs.
Okay, great. When she looked up during the day, past the rustic board fence her father had built at the edge of the property, she saw people in carriages passing on the Lexington Road, and beyond the road, pastures sparkling with wildflowers. When she rode at night by candlelight, she communed with a family of barred owls that lived in the broad branches of the huge elm tree outside her windows. As she rode during the day, she could sometimes look down from the window and see her father, not working in the gardens behind the house, but sitting on the bench with a pile of his finest red pippin, apples, waiting for the occasional traveler who might be ready for a dose of his own brand of high philosophical discourse. Sometimes Emerson dropped by. Sometimes Alcott would entertain a special visitor from Boston, like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, or Franklin Sanborn would wander up the Lexington Road to talk pedagogy, or one of the Hawthorne children would come over from next door. Beyond the meadows lay the shimmering water of Walden Pond and the fields and marshes where Louisa had taken so many passionate walks so long ago with her teacher and friend Thoreau. The little half-moon-shaped desk her father had built for her sat at the foot of Louisa's bed, surrounded by her books in a crowded cabinet bookcase, her sewing basket, family portraits, flower paintings by her older sister Anna, and a bust of the poet Schiller on the mantel. Although Orchard House was unheated except by fireplaces, and the Alcotts in later years often closed it up for the winter and moved to Boston, Louisa's room had a fireplace and windows facing south and west toward Concord. Her parents slept in the bedroom across the hall.
Could you say, how did you get this level of detail? I mean, some of the things, you know, about Bronson Alcott, it was pretty well known with him and his apples, but how did you get these details?
The details about Louisa's bedroom, I was just thinking as I read them, it's a photograph.
It's in the book, too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Essentially, I'm describing a photograph of her bedroom, including the bust of Schiller. And so in this case, a lot of the details come from photographs. A lot of the detail in my book came from letters and journals. And God bless these people, because they all wrote extensive letters and journals, just so extensive, so detailed about the furniture and what they ate and what they wore and what they did and the weather. And so it's possible to recreate a lot of scenes with pretty good detail.
And as you point out also, of course, so much of what Thoreau put into Walden came from his journals. You quote a wonderful sentence, "I went into the woods to live deliberately so that I might, from the essential facts of things, and might not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." You credit him with simultaneously inventing the memoir and the nature book.
Well, I think he did. I mean, Walden is sort of the first American memoir, and it took him 9 years to get Walden published, which is one reason why it's so good. He rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. But it's definitely written from memory. And he also wrote the nature book. I mean, that's what Walden is as well. But to go back to it being a memoir, Walden is very full of Thoreau's personality. And he was a very crotchety type. He hated rich people. He felt that it was never okay to drink alcohol. He was a strict vegetarian. He had some very crotchety ideas. He did not like taking charity. He had taken enough charity for a lifetime. And those ideas, you know, he used Walden to kind of express his own personality through recalled anecdotes and images, which is, I think, a definition of memoir.
Right. And I was also surprised that, I mean, he's such a great figure now, but he never achieved any kind of success or recognition, really, other than from the people who knew him when he was alive. And you mentioned Walden. It was an absolute bust.
It was, yes. It was.
Why?
I mean, mm-hmm. Well, it just, they didn't get it, you know? I mean, it wasn't, I mean, you know, The Scarlet Letter was a huge bestseller, and Little Women was a huge bestseller, and Walden was a very strange book. I mean, everybody thought that Thoreau was going to be the sad acolyte of James Russell Lowell when history was written.
But and of course, who was that?
Exactly. Exactly. That's not how it turned out. But Walden is such an extraordinary book, and I do think it is so extraordinary because it was rewritten so often.
And it, you know, he really was, is the word avatar? I mean, he was really ahead of his time.
He really was. He really was.
And it, ahead of his time by about 100 years.
Yes. Although he wasn't so much ahead of his time as ahead of our intelligence.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the things he wrote about were true then, you know, that you can find more solace in nature than you can in many things, that leading a simple life is a good thing to do for many, many reasons, that closeness to nature and the rhythms of nature are healing, that charity is awful, that it doesn't work and it only feels good to the giver and not to the receiver. You know, many of the things he wrote about were true then and are true now. We just didn't see it. I mean, it was just the reading public that failed to understand what a brilliant book it is.
You also say that both with Walden and with Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, that the impetus to write these masterpieces came with despair.
Well, and that's true of Little Women, too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book, of course, was to find out for myself what was behind this genius cluster of writers so that I could do what they did and write a masterpiece myself, I mean, of course. And what I found horrified me. What I found was that, it's certainly in those three cases, that the greatest work comes from really having nothing left to lose. And I hope that's not true. But if you look at Walden and The Scarlet Letter and Little Women, it's very interesting that these people were really, I mean, Hawthorne had given up writing, you know. They really were in a very dark place when these extraordinary works were written by them. I thought it was very interesting. And what's even more interesting is that I don't think Louisa May Alcott ever wrote a book again that was as good as Little Women.
Or before.
Nor did Hawthorne write a book again as good as The Scarlet Letter. Nor did Thoreau write another book. So it does suggest to me that although there perhaps isn't this big link that everybody thinks there is between writing and drinking and womanizing and carrying on, that there does seem to be a link between kind of intense creativity and really having nothing left to lose, really being at a point in your life where you just are ready to risk everything on, you know, a roll of the pen.
So you're kind of saying is this tortured genius theory is true?
Well, no, they weren't tortured. They were just, they were done.
Uh-huh. It's the giving up.
It's the giving up, I think, that sometimes creates the astonishing thing. But another thing to be said about both Hawthorne and Louisa is that because they had given up, and because they had both been through quite difficult passages in their life, I mean, Hawthorne lost his mother and got fired from his job, which he had only taken because he had given up writing, and then lost Margaret Fuller, who certainly was alive in his imagination, and Louisa had really lost everything. And in both those books, there's such a sublime quality of yearning for something that's been lost, yearning for something that didn't happen. I mean, Little Women, it just, to me, you can almost smell it coming off the page. I mean, that is the family that Louisa May Alcott so desperately, desperately wanted to have.
The one that was like her family, but the version she wished it had been.
Exactly. Because it wasn't really like her family that much at all.
Right.
You know, I mean, Louisa was the rebel, but she was not loved for being a rebel. She was disliked for being a rebel.
And her family was grindingly poor rather than genteelly poor.
Exactly. And she made up a servant, for instance, Hannah. It's complete fictitious. you know, and her sister's death was not a calm letting go, but rather a desperate, horrible. So I think it was close enough to what had happened so that she was just desperately yearning for it to be as it was. And I think Hawthorne also was very affected by Margaret Fuller, by her having an illegitimate child, by her death, and it just is yearning for her. And I think that sometimes intense yearning can be a tremendous goad to creativity, and that's a little more bearable information than having to think that you have to let go of absolutely everything, although that's probably true too.
And so have you been able to use that in your writing? Or do you anticipate using it?
Well, I have such a yearning for Concord. It's interesting. There's something about Concord, Massachusetts, and I'd like to write about Concord again. I feel a sort of yearning for Concord. You know, that lazy river, the willows brushing the water, all those things.
Well, Susan Cheever, it's a wonderful, fascinating story that you tell in American Bloomsbury. And I want to thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
The book is American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau. Their lives, their loves, their work. Susan Cheever is also the author of the memoir As Good As I Could Be, published in 2001, as well as numerous other books. You can go to the Writer's Voice website at writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from American Bloomsbury. Next up, we talk with Pamela Thompson about her stunning debut novel, Every Past Thing. That's right after this. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Every past thing becomes strange. That's how the protagonist of Pamela Thompson's debut novel begins the journal she writes within the book. Mary Jane Elmer is a young woman in 1899 who's come to New York from Shelburne, Massachusetts with her husband, the painter Edwin Romanzo Elmer. She and Edwin are still mourning the death of their young daughter Effie, but Mary Jane's thoughts are also taken up by her romantic longings for a young student with whom she had a brief encounter 10 years before, Jimmy Roberts. Thompson's novel, Every Past Thing, covers only the course of a week, but its depth and beautiful prose takes the reader on a far and satisfying journey. I'm joined here by associate producer Michael Pollitt.
Hello.
And by our guest, Pamela Thompson.
Hello there.
Well, Pamela, welcome to Writer's Voice. It's awfully nice to have you here. Having read your wonderful first published novel, Every Past Thing. And just to let our audience know a little bit about you, I think I've garnered 5 things about you. And if you can add anything to this, that might be great. But I know that you're editorial director at Interlink Books, Olive Branch Press in Northampton. I know that you live with your husband and 2 children in Worthington, which is almost around the corner up the hill. I recently found, I know you're a novelist too. Hey, how about that? And I found out today you're a blogger.
Oh, my gosh. That's a little secret
Is it really?
Well, it's very new.
It's very new. Ah, okay.
And I don't know if I can really agree to that noun.
Okay.
I am a blogger.
A blogger. Mm-hmm. Well,
carry on.
You have started such a project, what you want to do with it, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and that also you graduated from this very university of which WMUA belongs, and tell us just a little bit about that. What did you graduate with? And
Well, I came to the Valley to get my MFA in creative writing. So it is really true that I came to the Valley to figure out how to be a writer. So it somehow feels particularly comfortable and nice to come talk about that here in the basement of the same university.
That's right. Well, let's just jump right in then. What brought you to write this book? You know, you mention a picture at the Smith College Museum of Art. And, of course, the main characters started in Asheville and I understand ended up in New York, but they were in Shelburne Falls as well. That's all very close to us here. So what's your connection to this story and their lives? And
yeah. Well, I first saw the painting, you know, at the Smith Art Museum while I was in graduate school, and I was taking an art history class that, you know, really was about the same period of time that where my novel set in 1899, sort of Civil War through, you know, kind of into modernism. So I was prowling around the art museums, and when I saw this painting, I found it just so arresting and haunting, as I think, you know, many viewers at the art museum have. And I thought to myself, you know, when I saw it and was looking at it, okay, I'm going to write a novel about that painting one day. And I suppose it was thinking about, you know, the issues of making art and about grief, because this incredible painting only exists because his daughter died. And that, you know, kind of impossible puzzle of, you know, wanting to be a person who could, you know, make an incredible work of art, you know, write a novel, which seemed, you know, nearly impossible at the time. And I really wanted to be a person who also could, you know, have a child, which also seemed nearly impossible at the time. And so I was just really interested in that tangle of love and grief and making art. And I was also, I had just moved out to the hill towns, and so I was interested in the condition of being a rural artist and how, you know, how you never sort of stop in some way looking toward the city for legitimate, you know, legitimizing, I suppose. And that's what Edwin does in this novel. He goes to New York to, you know, somehow he feels starting out to make him a painter, which of course yes. He already is, you know.
Well, Francesca here. So this is about real places and real people. You just mentioned Edwin the painter. Tell us a little bit more about the characters in this novel, who they were, and how you found out about them, and what their story is.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's an incredible slim volume that the Smith Art Museum put out about the artist, and that was for me the starting point, though, as I say, it is slim, and there's not that much known. You know, it's not that there are published diaries that could be found, and the diary that the artist's wife, Mary, writes is, you know, all made up in this book. So I was started with a historical frame and then, you know, imagined the characters, who I'm sure are very different than those real people who lived, but the main characters are Edwin the painter and his wife Mary, his brother Samuel, who's a very accomplished businessman in New York, Jimmy Roberts, who is an anarchist and doctor who passed through their lives in Western Mass and now lives in New York, and there's Frank and Susanna Tannenbaum, who are two young anarchists in New York.
And they're not real, is that right?
They are not real.
But there's Emma Goldman as well.
There's Emma Goldman, too. And it was really interesting to follow the Susan Cheever, because I think along with Emma Goldman, those other real characters of Louisa May Alcott and why is his name just Emerson? How could I forget Emerson's name? They're sort of central presiding spirits that, you know, inform the characters' lives, I think.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, Mary really takes Emerson as a kind of model, as I think, you know, many people did, a model and inspiration for a kind of way, a spirit of inquiry, you know, of kind of watching her own mind at work, which I think is what is so powerful about Emerson's, you know, persistent tracing of his own liveliness. And so she follows that. And I think, you know, anarchists like Emma Goldman were really influenced by those transcendentalists, too. It's sort of a backbone of a certain kind of American thought, really, that isn't the American thought that's holding sway these days, but I wish it were.
You write this as a historical and a fictional, a mix of fiction and history. Could you talk a little bit more about this mix? You know, what were some of the, you know, the guiding principles that you found or that you learned in creating this combination?
Yeah, well, I think it's something that made me not write the novel initially because I felt, you know, kind of too much responsibility to the real people and the real history. And I definitely had to get over a kind of piece, I don't know, a number of years of thinking it's not my right to tell that story. And so I did have a real sense of caution about going into it. And finally, you know, I think that I started thinking about it, about like a kind of gossip, you know, that we're always thinking and making stories up about each other's lives and about our own lives, you know, and trying to understand our own progress through this world. And so, you know, finally, it's just one day I thought, well, I can do that to these characters. It's all right. I mean, you know, that I can use them to ask the questions that I want to ask.
And we're talking with Pamela Thompson about her really stunningly written book, her debut novel, Every Past Thing. And I just want to say for our listeners, I've already told Pamela this. I actually think that this is a beautifully, beautifully written book. The language is so rich.
And let's get into some of that language and your choice of how to bring these people to life. It's a lot of stream of consciousness type of writing, and I see now the connection to Emerson from what you've said. But talk a little bit more about that, and it's a lot of Mary Elmer's stream of consciousness. Deliberate choice? How did that come up that you were going to present it in that way?
Well, you know, I think it's striking me right now that, you know, it is such a difficult thing to write a novel or at least it was for me. And whenever there's a sort of liberating moment, I find, you know, you need to go with it. And one of the liberating moments was thinking, you know, why write a novel at all in this day and age? You know, why not just make a movie? And so, you know, knowing that I was going to write a novel when I, you know, said, well, because, you know, I want to insist on that secret life of the mind, it seemed to me the only thing that really I want it to be in a novel. And I mean, of course, there are scenes in this and you know, considerable drama in some ways, but to me, the point of a novel is about consciousness. And so, you know, it seems obvious that would be the technique, you know, just for how I understand the use of the novel.
And did you write it in the language of the time? I mean, did you consciously adopt what you would imagine the style of thought?
Well, I think this is, you're reminding me what I was going to say. Another liberating moment was just realizing that I wanted to take some more old-fashioned idea of language. And I was rereading W.E.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk, and I was really kind of re-astonished by his conviction in the sentence, you know, where he really believed that if something were stated carefully and precisely and beautifully enough, that, you know, a problem could be understood in a way that could change the world. And you know, it's crazy to talk like that in a certain way, but I thought, well, that's actually what's interesting to me. And so, you know, I'm going to set this novel in 1899, and I'm going to pretend that that's possible for sentences. You know, I'm going to write like that. I'm going to try not to be ironic in a certain way. But, you know, it's a little risky. You know, it comes out sounding different than contemporary prose.
It strikes me that that then gave you license to write as beautifully as you do.
And Mary is writing a, I thought she was writing a book, but I guess it's just a sort of a journal, or she may, I always got the sense that she intended to have some writing come out of this, but she's writing a journal called The Green Book throughout this story. But was that actually an artifact of Mary's, or is that something also?
It's not. But I love when people ask me that because, you know, I love the idea of it really existing and that there was really some, you know, ancient green book that I had at my fingertips. And some days I probably wish that there were one. But no, it's all made up.
And, you know, almost reading those bits where she talks about her book, I imagine the author using the green book, that the author writing was the same as the person writing the green book. Do you know what I...
It almost seemed like that was your voice
that's possibly
coming through. Is there an identity there?
It's interesting. I mean, I think that I had very different ideas for what the green book would be at the beginning than what I end it with. And for me, one of the dramas of writing it was, you know, can Mary write whatever it is that she needs to write, which, you know, I didn't always know precisely what that was, but it was something about, you know, a kind of puzzle about her past. And, you know, when I started out, I think that I thought something that seems really silly to me now, which is that the progress of Mary writing the Green Book would in some way parallel my own progress writing the novel, and that the voices at some point would become indistinguishable. And, you know, it's crackpot. You know, you can't decide what these, you know, you can't, I mean, you can have ideas and we can't escape them, I suppose. But eventually I realized about Mary that, you know, she's actually not really a writer as like I'm a writer. And that when Mary actually got to the point of writing enough of the story, you know, so that she solved, I think, a little puzzle. She brought herself up to sort of living in the present, I think, which she hadn't been doing. Then, you know, she's also a little bit like what Samuel, her brother-in-law, says, which is that, you know, she loves too many things to be just a writer. And I think she's more of a talker, you know, in a way, than a writer, which is not to say, you know, that the Green Book doesn't matter to her.
Well, Pamela Thompson, I wonder if you might grace us with a passage from Every Past Thing. That's your novel. Wonder if you could read something from, it starts on page 172, and maybe set it up for us a little bit. What's happening here?
All right. This is a part where Mary is thinking about, is sort of wakes up from dreaming about Jimmy Roberts, who, when she last saw him, was, you know, like a young man, a 16-year-old, a 17-year-old, off to college for the first time, and he stayed with her and her husband in Western Massachusetts before he went on to Columbia and New York. And now she's in New York and wondering if she'll find him and see him again, but instead she's dreamed him. Then he was gone. That much happened in not even an instant, in no time that can rightly be called minute, second, or any fraction thereof. She knew she was dreaming him, yet her hands held the shape of him, the muscles of his arms he'd got from rowing the Charles at dawn, the hard coil of him she needn't have parted his pants to know. Mary holds her hands up and watches how they tremble. She shakes all over, as if she just loved him in the grasses and climbed in the window after, trying to still her heart to not wake Lucy. If this shaking is real, Edwin will wake and see this trembling and ask what troubles her. Why should the cause not be what it seems, that she has made love to Jimmy Roberts this morning? In some scullery of time, she writes, tucked away in the basement of the grand house of years, the activity of this dark corner easily forgotten or overlooked, yet without them the inhabitants of the house would starve to death. And if she has made love to Jimmy Roberts, why not believe that this pulse has passed through him, too? She feels him close beside her in agreement. Mary, he says, Mary. He has only to say her name, and she shakes all over. But she's not afraid of this power he has over her. She can create life. He's not here in her ordinary daytime world. She knows he is not. But the veins threading his muscles pulse under her fingers, and she sees brown hairs growing sparsely over his lips and feels his breath. If he were to speak, her breath would meet his. Another world exists. In it, he is with her. There is only astonishment to be holding him after so long. She cannot write. She cannot think. She cannot talk. Too many words will break the spell, pull her back to this world she daily calls ours. He disappears, and she lets him go.
You know, the thought process is so precisely delineated. It really seems that you inhabit the consciousness of your characters in such an intimate way, more than just kind of documenting their conversations or their actions. How did you get yourself so intimately into the mind of your characters?
I don't know.
You're not supposed to say that.
I mean, you know, I really don't know. But the truth is, there is something about this dream moment that did really kind of happen to me, where, you know, I think that sometimes there are these really startling dreams where you're really aware of, you know, something that feels like a different world. And this dream that I had really was about, you know, a person who was no longer, you know, in our world existing, you know, and being right there. And it was very palpable. And, you know, and it's interesting, the only other dream that I ever had actually in my life that seemed so much like I could not tell that it wasn't real after I woke up was when I was writing my earlier graduate school novel, and I had kind of the opposite kind of dream, which was that I had murdered someone. And when I woke up, and I mean, it's not, you know, it was just some stranger who was bothering us in the Pleasant Street Theater. It was no one I know. But the thing about that dream was that I woke up not, you know, thinking, okay, now am I going to go in and, you know, turn myself in to the police? And, you know, and I'm sure that that really had to do with my first novel. And this moment of a dead person seeming alive has to do with this novel.
Well, then let me ask you about the morning, because as much as there is, you know, there's this very erotic undercurrent through much of the novel, well, not just undercurrent, but current, there's also a theme of loss that runs through it and of grief. So you've just talked about how you had a moment like this where you were able then to express this, to write this passage in the book. I don't want to necessarily ask you, you know, to tell us your life story, but what about the other emotions, the emotions like grief, the way in which you can, you do go so, with such detail into that thought process? It seems to me that there's a way of getting to the truth of a matter, the heart, that is a difficult thing to do in writing, and I'd like to ask you, you know, how do you do that?
Yeah, again, I'm going to say, I don't know, but I mean, the thing about grief that strikes me, I mean, it's really, you know, in a way, the same thing almost, I think, as desire. You know, it's like it's about wanting something that you can't have, or someone to be with you. And so, you know, it seems like that's what desire is made of to me. And I think that, you know, there's a lot about being a new mother, and now a not such a new mother, in this book, you know, where it's sort of a daily question to me sometimes how you go on with the brute facts of life. And you know, to me, this was a novel about that, you know, where there were so many times when I would just wake up in the middle of the night and think, what's sort of at the beginning of this novel, of like, you know, in this house, the four of us, one of us will die first. And then the next, and you know, and how, you know, and I would just, not be able to do anything except try to, you know, go right. Because, you know, or then thinking about the condition of Edwin and Mary losing their only child. And, you know, in a certain way, of course, that's everyone's great, every parent's great fear. But then I thought, well, on the other hand, to be able to, you know, be there when your child is born and then also be there when they die. I mean, actually, you know, in the ordinary order of things in which, you know, parents die after children, you know, the thought of one day, you know, I hope my children, me long gone and, you know, my child 90, the idea of not being there at the moment they die, you know, that seemed impossible to me too. So, I mean, you know, the book is really about a kind of middle of life contemplation of the fact that we won't be around forever.
It's so interesting to me that you've brought up here a link between grief and desire, because both Francesca and I thought that that's really what the book was about, was mm-hmm. desire was the stronger course running sure. through it rather than grief. But you've linked them very closely.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have anything more to say about that or about desire in the book. I mean, Mary yeah. desires to change. And
yeah. Well, I think, I mean, it's very similar to how, you know, that last segment ended about the yearning. You know, it's like, I mean, I think grief is intimately part of the desire, but then, you know, the sort of desire can be channeled to pay attention to the living as well. And, you know, it's the question that I started thinking about the novel with, about, you know, the obvious grief that made him make this painting. But then there's something about the desire and liveliness and the joy in creation of the painting as well. So I guess I was always thinking about that twinning. You know.
In the beginning of your novel, I kind of got the sense that the women were a bit lost and floundering or anyway unaware of their own potential. But the men seemed to have a lot more control over their lives. You know, mm-hmm. they knew what they were doing. Well, at least Samuel certainly knows what he's doing. Right. And even Edwin has a greater sense of, you know, settledness. But by the end of the book, it seems more like the men who are lost and are questioning what they've accomplished, while your female characters seem much clearer.
Huh. That's an interesting progression. I mean, I never thought of it going that way. But I think a lot of the shape of the first part of the book, the tentativeness of it, is, you know, about Mary figuring out a way.
It was as if Mary's search for herself, and for her long-lost love, gave her a strength that she hadn't had before.
Hmm. It's interesting. Or, you know, I think also that Mary, like Samuel, you know, there's a lot about Mary and Samuel being people who talk. I think that also Mary was really looking for a community, you know, which wasn't something that Edwin needed to look for. You know, I often thought of him as a solitary painter, like in that Joni Mitchell song, I'm a lonely painter, I live in a box of paints. You know, and I think artists can often be like that, but I think that's not who Mary is. So I think that she drew strength and clarity from, you know, the excitement of meeting those other people who had such different and liberating visions of life in that new century.
Now, on your blog, you write the phrase that you have a recovery from the long sickness of writing a novel. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what is that sickness, and are you ready to get sick again?
Oh, gosh. I forgot I wrote that. You know, it does feel like that to me in a certain way, which is that, you know, when you're sick, which, you know, I am now, everything is a bit colored by that fact. And I think that's what I mean. Writing a novel, you're never out of it. I mean, no matter what you're doing, you know, so you're, you know, staying home Saturday night while the rest of your family goes out to dinner or at the friends, or, you know, there's that, the staying home like people do when they're sick. but it's that it never goes away, you know, and everything refers to it. Everything, you know, everything that I was doing always, you know, what I needed to read, what I saw, what I looked at, you know, any human experience I had was, you know, possible fodder for belonging somewhere to these characters. And the characters, you know, they're living in my house with me, you know.
And did you have any trouble knowing when it had come to an end?
A little bit, because I did initially have this other idea about a kind of another section to it that was going to be Maud's part. And Maud in Seattle, Maud is Edwin and Mary's niece, and she in real life did go out to Seattle and teach art. And then, you know, it was another one of those liberating moments which you need where you say, actually, you know, I'm going to end it here.
Well, that's great. And I know you're doing some local events where you're going to be speaking about the novel. You've got an event coming up on January 31st. That's a Thursday at noon. At the Springfield Art Museum, you'll be talking there, and I'd like to let our listeners know that they can go to your website at pamela-thompson.com. So it's www.pamela-thompson.com. Thanks so much, Pamela Thompson, for coming in and talking about your wonderful novel, Every Past Thing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pamela. It's nice to have such a wonderful writer so close to us here at home. Thank you.
Thanks.
And you can read an excerpt from Every Past Thing on our website, writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we talk about the real causes of cancer, autoimmune diseases, and other ailments, the poisons that surround us. We talk with two experts in the field of environmental medicine. Dr. Deborah Davis tells us about the secret history of the war on cancer, and Dr. Paul Blanc talks about how everyday products make people sick. Find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming authors at our website, writersvoice.net. It's newly designed by our hero, Bill Way, web designer extraordinaire. You can leave your comments there and listen to or download past shows. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.